removal by actual consumption. So there's been some work done with Tidean mites, and of course I'm going to be talking to you today about these coccinellates. So previously, we do have some observations of biology and natural history in this tribe. As early as 1893, Kibele did recognize the mycophagous habit of an Australian species. And the species that I'm working with, Cyloborea bagentium maculata, was described in 1921 as an obligate mycophage through some really neat classical experiments where Davidson offered up lots of different prey items in kind of no-choice feeding trials, and did determine that it takes powdery mildew for these things to survive. And then again, there was some really neat ecological work done in Australia recently by Anderson. So some more biology work. Again, it's a cosmopolitan species, so you find in the literature all over the world people have been playing around with this clade a little bit. It's really neat, too, that these insects tend to be general on powdery mildew. So even though they only eat powdery mildew, they eat powdery mildew on lots of different plants. So you see this work was done in Syria and Turkey, where this species of Cyloborea was recorded to feed on the powdery mildew of 52 different plant species. So then, we do have a little bit of work previously in biological control or consumption. Lots of workers have recognized mycophagous habits and recognized that there may be a possibility for use in biological control. But to my knowledge, the only person who's tried to quantify that was a group in Turkey, and they exposed powdery mildew-infected leaves to larvae and then measured the conidia concentrations on fed upon areas of the leaves versus non-fed upon, and were actually able to observe a measurable difference. So that brings me to my personal project. I'm evaluating this Western North American species, Cyloborea bagentium maculata, for possible use in biological control, especially in contained environments such as a greenhouse. So the overall objectives are many. First, I wanted to get a handle on the biology, natural history, and in my area, I wanted to see where this beetle occurs, what plant species it's associated with. But then also, we have some kind of classical biological control items on the agenda here. We have a functional response, we have kind of the aggregative response, and then we have some IPM items on the agenda. Compatibility with fungicides is very important to me, and it seems like there could be a really interesting effect of systemic insecticides and trophic movement of systemic insecticides. But today, I think I'm only going to have time to talk about the biology a little bit, and perhaps we'll get into the consumption quantification work that I've been recently doing. So again, this species, Cyloborea bagentium maculata, is Western North American. It was established way back in 1921 as an obligate, but then since then, nobody's worked on it at all. I haven't seen any work really, except for some records in surveys, entomological surveys and whatnot. It's very common. You start looking for it, you find it all over the place. It's very widespread, but it is considered one species. There are some clinal external morphological differences over the range of the species. And again, this is kind of a serendipitous project. It was observed in a greenhouse back in 2003 when I first began as a graduate student, feeding on some powdery mildew of gerbera and roses in one of Dr. Perella's biocontrol houses. And so as a good student, I asked Dr. Perella, I said, what's this coccinella eating? And he didn't know. So we got the animal identified and found out it was mycophage there in the crop. So one of the first things we did is we wanted to establish a colony. And that's much more difficult than it sounds. We're dealing with an obligate plant parasite and an obligate mycophage. So we need live plants, live powdery mildew, and beetles. But we were able to do it, and we have a rotating colony in this manner here. So another thing that we did right away is we wanted to look at the life cycle. The larva goes through four instars, and we did some rectangular degree day modeling and predicted that it takes about 280 degree days from egg to adult. Okay, so then I wanted to look at kind of the phenology out in the landscape. And so we did this through presence-absence sampling on a weekly basis of over 30 different plant species that were known to be susceptible to powdery mildew in the area of Davis, California, in the Central Valley of California. And we were tracking not only the insects and the fungi, but we were looking at weather, and we had density indices that we created for both the insects and the fungi, and we used a variety of multivariate statistics to deal with those relationships. So this is just a little map of our campus-wide survey. It was actually pretty extensive. I would get on my bike once a week and travel this 10-kilometer circuit, visiting all these different plants, and we had excellent cooperation from the Arboretum there on campus. If you guys have visited Davis, it's a beautiful place. The Student Farm, which is an organic subscription farm, and some other gardens and grounds plantings on campus there. And here's just some quick results of the seasonal phenology. The blue curve that you see here is the actual powdery mildew severity over time. And you can see it's pretty static. There's some little peaks here and there. And then the orange is the density that was observed of the beetles out there. So you see what we found out there in the field is at different times of the year, we found the beetles on different plants. And this corresponded to the times of the year that the powdery mildew was active on the plants. So in the early season here, here's the mouse. This is the early season, actually this is the spring. So we found it on roses primarily. And then later in the season, it was found more readily on plants like crepe myrtle, grapes, and cucurbits late in the season. And then of course we have this area of the curve here where the beetle is not encountered. And this is the overwintering period during the winter. It's somewhat cold and very wet in California. So here's my partial list. It's kind of a list in progress of all of the plants that we have observed this insect to utilize as a powdery mildew host, and the list is growing all the time. And another really neat thing that we saw, and this may speak to kind of an aggregative response, is as powdery mildew severity increased in the field, we saw increasing density of the insect. And this was really pronounced in vineyards. So we're actually doing some work in vineyards where we're looking to use the insect as an indicator of powdery mildew. You know, we're dealing with this monoculture, and California vineyards can be huge, so it's difficult to know where and when you may have a powdery mildew problem out there in the crop. So that's a different project, different talk. So the conclusions here, in Central California at least, we did notice activity of this insect from February through December, so most of the year, and the insect does accept a wide range of plants as powdery mildew hosts and as food sources. And it seems that the adults can locate powdery mildew somehow at low densities in a heterogeneous landscape. We think it may be a spore gradient or perhaps some olfactory cues from the plants or from the fungi themselves. So that's very interesting to us. So we really wanted to try to quantify, you know, how much can these things eat? And that's kind of the first step. We haven't really gotten into a classical functional response series of experiments yet. But first, what I wanted to ask is how much does one larva of this insect eat? And can we record that? Can we observe that? And can we measure that? So what we decided to do is we had leaf discs in the laboratory of Zinnia elegans that were infected with powdery mildew. These came from the colony. And we released onto these one neonate individual per disc. The other thing here is half of the discs were retained as a growth measurement of powdery mildew that would occur in the absence of the insects, because powdery mildew is going to be growing if the conditions are amenable to that. And the way we measured powdery mildew severity or percentage on the leaf was through digital photography. And then there's a really neat image analysis software that can separate pixels based on saturation or hue and assign a percentage powdery mildew coverage on these leaf discs. And we could express that again as a percentage, or we could convert it into an area, since we knew the area of the leaf discs. So I'll skip over that a little bit. So we created this linear model. It was based on two main terms. We had the leaf area consumed, or kind of the leaf area cleaned, I should say, the leaf area cleaned, and then we had the growth of powdery mildew that was going on concurrently. And so the really interesting thing, or the main thing here is we saw that there was a little more than 6 square centimeters consumed by each larva from egg to pupa. It doesn't seem like a whole lot, but again, we're dealing with 3 millimeter long insects, small insects, large leaves. So again, we were able to see a significant decrease that we could measure visibly, and that was important. This is a really neat picture on the left. It seems this larva ate so much, he decided to pupate right there on the leaf. So we'd like to extrapolate this. Can we create some type of a predictive model that will apply to various horticultural systems in real time, and that will incorporate actual population flux rather than just one larva and a snapshot? So the question here is, could we create a release rate model, a release rate calculator, that would tell us how many adult beetles we need to release in a given system in order to bring about adequate control in a set period of time? And so this model was adapted from the individual feeding model, and it incorporates a Leslie matrix to deal with population flux. And of course, the control is reached when this equation is satisfied. So on one side of the equation, we have the initial powdery mildew severity multiplied by the leaf area, which these things can be estimated in our system. And then we have a vector of leaf area cleaned by each larval instar, and a population vector that we get from our Leslie matrix population calculations multiplied by the number of adults we release into the system. In order to evaluate this model, we decided to compare it to some real data. And the real data was derived from a small efficacy trial that we conducted in the greenhouse in cages. So in these cages, we had some Gerbera infected with powdery mildew at uniform rates, and we had 3 treatments. We released in each cage either 0, 25, or 50 beetles. These were unsexed beetles, and it was assumed that they were 50% female. And then again, we tracked the powdery mildew severity over time through this image analysis method that I explained earlier. So first, let me show you just the results of the efficacy trial. So you see on the left a sample of the visual images here of 0, 25, or 50 beetles. And then the curves actually show that there was a reduction, or a measurable reduction, when you compare it to the control being 0 beetles. Our model worked out pretty well. It seems that it underestimated things a little bit, and there's several reasons for that. I guess it's time to go to these overall conclusions. So overall, it looks like this insect in specific possesses some attributes that can be viewed as vital to success as a biological control agent, and it may also be used as an indicator or locator of powdery mildew in a varied system. And then, of course, I think there's a place for it in integrated pest management if we work out the issues with fungicide and systemic insecticide toxicity. So the desirable attributes, it is obligated to feed on powdery mildew, as far as we know. It does tend to aggregate, and it does remove measurable amounts. The really neat thing, I think, is it's a cosmopolitan genus. So classical biological control is not a necessity. We can actually use the agents that are right there in our backyard. Real quick, some of the possible IPM applications. Again, I talked about powdery mildew indication, spore reduction in a greenhouse to remove the inoculum potential, outbreak prevention in a greenhouse. And then I have this picture here of a larva grazing on a grape. And so a lot of times you have powdery mildew on grapes post-harvest. So it may be a stretch, but there may be a possibility for some type of a post-harvest cleanup or activity. Real quick, last slide. I think it's important to note that there is a possibility that this insect is actually transmitting powdery mildew from plant to plant. I have here some real nice automontage images, and you can see spores and conidia towers on these larvae and on the adults. And so I'd like to conduct some transmission tests. I haven't done that yet. We'll see how that works out. I'd like to thank my collaborators and open the floor for any questions. Thank you.
Quick question?
Yes, sir.
Mutualism between the beetle and the fungus, the same way that
it's definitely a possibility. In the field, in nature, what you tend to see is kind of typical of coccinellids. You don't see the beetles show up until powdery mildew is raging in the field. So I think there would have to be a kind of a temporal aspect to that. You know, maybe, I guess you're talking about kind of like a farming aspect where we're going to inoculate this plant. And it takes some time. You know, once you've inoculated a plant with powdery mildew, until you're going to have a sufficient disease problem to warrant the presence of these beetles. But I do think that's a distinct possibility. Okay, thank you.
So as Tiffany said, my name's Wyatt Hoback, and I actually have a joint appointment between University of Nebraska Kearney, which is a undergraduate institution of about 6,000 students. We also have a master's program, and the University of Nebraska Lincoln Department of Entomology. And so when Tiffany approached me about this subject, the topic was generally requiring undergraduate research as a component of a biology degree. And as I thought about that, I thought there's a lot of different ways that I can approach this question. I thought about when I was an undergraduate student at a small liberal arts college in Virginia, undergraduate research was a requirement. And now as a professor at the University of Nebraska Kearney, we require it of all of our students. And that undergraduate requirement for me really helped galvanize the areas that I'm interested in. As an undergraduate in Virginia, I worked on a federally endangered insect species, and that work has carried over into my professional career. Well, Tiffany gave me some guidelines as to what I should cover, and one of the guidelines was, why is it important as part of the core? And I think Tiffany did a very good job of summarizing why most people feel that independent research is important to the core of a degree in science. Basically, it develops the student's ability to conduct and analyze and be a scientist. A couple brief examples of projects, how it impacts recruitment and retention, some assessment data. So, do the students benefit from the projects? And what have we as a biology department done to improve the undergraduate research experience? So hopefully, in training undergraduates in biology, they're not left with the question upon graduation of now what. The undergraduate research experience should confirm that they want to be a biologist and want to seek out experiences doing science, or maybe not so bad either, figure out that they really don't like their major and they never want to do science again. Either way, we think it benefits students to have that experience struggling through a project, problem solving, and collecting data. So this is a picture of a undergraduate named Joe, and he's out in the middle of a potato field, and he's collecting leaf area data using a LIGOR instrument that costs several thousand dollars. And this really epitomizes what an undergraduate project is about. So it's independent. He's out in that potato field by himself. He needs to make decisions about reentry times if any pesticides have been sprayed. He needs to know what he's doing in collecting data, and he needs to be trusted not to lose the data or the instrument. Okay. Beyond that, Joe needs to have some training in how to collect data, how many samples are needed, and the type of question he's asking. And so when we think about this as a requirement of a degree program, there's some significant considerations that have to be made. As a department, we asked ourselves, are students prepared to do scientific research? Now, it's been a requirement in our department since 1989, and we examined this question in 2005, so long overdue. We took a very hard look at undergraduate core courses. And we asked ourselves, do these courses prepare students to be scientists? For example, how many of our core courses require students to get primary literature, read that information, and synthesize it? And the answer, of course, was very little. Our courses are driven by content. We already don't have enough time to teach the students what they absolutely have to know about ecology, genetics, etc., to also expect that they can read the literature. are they able to formulate a research idea? Well, without knowing the primary literature and the direction that science is moving in,